Hello, everyone. I'm Louis Vargas, and you're listening to episode 37 of the Art Scene Podcast. Marcela Pardo Arisa returns to the podcast today to catch up and talk about what she's been up to since she last came on a couple years ago. But before I play our conversation, let me tell you about a few things that are happening here in the Bay Area. First, over at Part 2 Gallery in Oakland, there's a solo exhibition by Mariel Pataki titled Not Long for This World, which will be showing through April 5th. Then, out of the Berkeley Art Museum's Matrix program, a new exhibition of work by Masako Miki is on display through April 28th. The Matrix 273 exhibition features larger-than-life-size felt-covered forms drawn from the Japanese folk belief in yokai, or shapeshifters, who can disguise themselves in any number of different forms. Utilizing brilliant colors, the installation moves from three-dimensional forms to abstract images on the floor and walls. Lastly, former guest of the podcast Mark Saab has a solo exhibition at Swim Gallery in San Francisco titled The Cave, powered by Felt Zine. The show features 3D-inspired experimental video and large-scale artwork. All right, now here's my conversation with my guest Marcela Pardo Arisa, where we talk about women art handlers and the current exhibition she curated at Southern Exposure titled The Tallest Part of the Arch.
I think it's been almost 2 years since you've been on the podcast.
Wow.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
That's
almost
a long time.
It is. And it doesn't feel like it's a long time. But one of the, you know, last time you were here, we talked about a lot about where you're from, your education, like how you got to the United States, which was a very interesting story because you went to school in Indiana, if I remember right.
That's right.
Yeah. but you're originally from Columbia. Mm-hmm. But this time, you know, I want to talk a little bit more about the type of work you do, because you do, you're an artist yourself. And aside from just your art practice, you're involved in a lot of different things. And even in the last 2 years, you've been really busy. So one of the very first things I think I want to start with, because it's closing soon, is Bay Area Now 8. That's the big one, right? Which, for listeners out there who don't know, Bay Area Now 8 is now in its eighth iteration, which we also know as BAN 8, is I think every 3 years,
yeah,
right?
Triennial.
Yeah, triennial art like exhibition that the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts puts on, exhibiting artists from all over the Bay Area. And you've been fortunate to be one of the artists featured in the show.
Yeah.
And first, tell me about that whole experience of how you wanted to be a part of it, how you got considered, like the whole part of getting your work ready for that show.
Totally. So, full disclosure, I work at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in the community engagement department. So I knew that the curators were looking at local artists and doing studio visits. And I was completely caught off guard when I was at work and I read the email with the invitation, and I just looked at the visual arts team and I was just kind of like, what? This is crazy, because I really didn't know whether or not I could be considered, right? And, you know, just learning about the process and learning about this Bay Area Now and the SICA Award are kind of like the only two opportunities for local artists to be featured in a bigger exhibition here. So I was excited that even though I was working in the institution, I could also be considered as a visual artist. So that was a really exciting opportunity. And the other thing is that, I was really stoked to be featured alongside other people who I really admired from before, such as like Jamil Helu or like Sahar or Taraban, and people who I've seen grow throughout the years, like Nikki Green or Sadie Barnett or Andrew Wilson. So seeing the spectrum of the list, you know, I was a little bit speechless and completely honored. And it also made me realize the space that I was in, right? So I started thinking about what does it mean to be in the Bay Area? I'm not from here, so what's my relationship to it? And I started thinking about why I moved here, and a lot of it was because of the photography legacy it has and the queer histories it holds So I wanted to make a little bit of a connection between the past and the present, since it is such a a triennial exhibition that has been around for a couple of years. And I started kind of going through different archives in the city, some of them were in the San Francisco Public Library, some of them were in the GLBT Historical Society archives.
So you actually did some research on it before even beginning to make the work.
Yeah. Because I wanted the work to be localized in one way or another.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to go back to the sources of these histories. And for me, archives, especially queer archives, are kind of like a golden mine. First, because I cannot even imagine a queer archive in Colombia. They're still being sourced. And I feel like there's so many images here that are being kept in boxes.
Sure.
So it felt like a good opportunity for me to understand that history better and to also understand where the blind spots might be at. And in doing this process, I realized first that the archive is a very arbitrary place. when you think about archive, you think it's very comprehensive, but in fact, the order of it changes as the years move by,
sure.
The technology changes, there's certain protocols, like you can only take one box at a time. There's a lot of anonymous pictures that are being depicted, and even how you can relate to those pictures can be very restricted. So it felt like all of these photographs were kind of put away in this, with a lot of care for sure. But I wanted to invite those bodies from the past to interact with bodies from the present. so I printed a lot of these images. And the bodies that were in images in life size, and I had them interact with current queers who live in the Bay, who a lot of them are also visual artists. Mm-hmm. So we created images together where they're holding one another. So I would have these cutouts. I would invite the models to kind of choose someone that they felt moved by or someone that they would have a connection with.
Yeah.
And I would ask them to hold them like a sister or like a brother. To create this kind of impossible historical kinship. So it was, for me, it was a way of connecting the past and the present, to lay on the past also and to think about what we want the future to look like. And all of these are photographs that are also embedded into, unconventional frames that I've made with some paint accents in the walls.
Oh yeah, I mean, I have to. It's my one of my most favorite parts about your work is that I think you've been one of the few artists I've seen, as photographers in particular, that are able to find a way to hang photographs in a wall, but then still have it almost become part of the wall itself. I mean, there's that one piece that literally is in the corner of the space at Ban 8 where. You built the frame for it to fit in the corner.
Yeah.
And which I love. I mean, it's so innovative to me because it makes it more, the photograph more interesting than just having it traditionally two-dimensional on a wall.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I like to, to find ways to respond to the architecture that is holding the work.
Yeah.
And for that specific work of the corner, there's a lot of hands that are crossing over.
Yeah.
So I really like, connecting planes in different ways.
Oh, for sure. And even the way you use the paint where you have, usually associated with the color that's predominantly shown in the photograph, mm-hmm. you have you paint the wall a little bit and you have it sometimes going down. In some other spaces, I've seen you even have it go down to the wall down to the floor, from the mm-hmm. wall to the floor. And I even asked you, if someone was ever by this work, what would they... should they exhibit it? And you were like, yeah, actually, if they want to, and you even provide, you would provide them the paint.
Yeah, right? Totally. Paint and instructions.
Yeah.
DIY for everybody.
How long is that, as Bay Area Now 8 still going on for?
It closes on March 24th.
March
24th.
Yeah. So speaking of the YBCA, and you mentioned it a little bit earlier about you also work there.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about tell me about the department you work for. And tell me about the type of work you do. And then three, how you even got to do that, how you got to be able to do this job.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, the reason why I was kind of excited to be involved with YBCA to begin with was because it had that structure of a non of like an unconventional art center. So they don't have a collecting. They're not a collecting institution. So in a way, they're able to respond faster to things that are currently happening, which I was drawn to. I really liked that they were showing performances, they had gallery spaces, they had more public programs and like convenings and things like that. But what I was most drawn to was the idea of interdisciplinary collaboration. So I started working at YBCA maybe 2 years ago. And I started working mostly with the fellowship program and some contextual programming for some of the members. And the idea was to deepen the relationship between a program that's just giving and a program that where you're expected to already know the person that's presenting and kind of give a little bit more background, maybe share someone who's giving a different perspective or who's building upon something like that. and the other one was the fellowship program that Mark Bamuti Joseph started and I would work with Amy Vasquez in, which is, you know, it's a fellowship that brings in people from different disciplines to work on an inquiry together. So, for instance, a year and a half ago, we had the inquiry of where's our public imagination? And this was a quote from architect Teddy Cruz mm-hmm. and Fauna Foreman, who presented at YBCA before. So we invited people to apply to this inquiry. And you get, you know, you get journalists, human rights activists, designers, artists, choreographers to work together on this thing. So in theory, everybody who applies to the fellowship is interested in a similar thing, but they're all coming to the question from their own disciplines and their ways of communicating with each other. And the objective of the fellowship, or like one of them, is to foster collaboration that wouldn't happen otherwise. So in the paths that we're in professionally, we're less and less likely to run into people who are from other fields.
Right.
And therefore, that kind of skews our perspective on how to deal with a problem.
Sure.
So the idea of this is to actually bring ourselves back to a point where we can communicate with one another in relatable ways. So that initiative was very appealing to me. It was still very abstract at the moment, so we've been shaping it for the last 2 years. We've worked with over 200 people.
Wow.
A lot of them, they're incredible. They're doing incredible work in the world in so many different facets and forms. And I think there's some values that we all share together.
Sure.
And it has also, in a way, broadened my way of understanding how we relate to art and culture. And it has also reinforced the fact that culture is fundamental in societal change.
And what do you think? I mean, it's just, I feel like it's a silly question to ask because you're so involved in different things. But when it comes to this particular job, what do you hope to do in the future? Like, do you see yourself still doing that same type of thing at the same place for a lot longer, or even another place, another mm-hmm. type of institution? If you were to ever work anywhere else,
yeah, I'm always very open to how life works.
Yeah,
and I'm also very curious, and I always want to keep on learning. So I have a lot of possibilities in my head of what could be the next step or
sure.
what I'm thinking about. I think my objective in all of this is always creating space for better representation for, you know, for women, for queer, trans, people of color in the arts.
Sure.
And to be more aware of labor practices in the art world.
Yeah.
That's kind of my big objective.
Yeah.
But that can take so many different forms, right? So,
sure.
I would love for that to happen in photography because photography is how... It you know, takes a lot of how we understand visual culture.
Absolutely.
And I think representation of a lot of different folks aren't being considered currently in the way that it should be. That can also happen in different types of projects. So I got involved with, I co-founded the Women Art Handlers group.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Yeah.
With my friend Kat Rotaris, who is now currently working at SFAI, but used to work at SFMOMA as a preparator. And we both... you know, met when we were doing our MFA. We both were doing a lot of preparatory work and we faced a lot of like misogynistic, weird moments. I think we're both very ravenous and persistent.
Yeah, because it's a field that for the unfortunately for the most part, like males have been like hired for, right? Like and for our listeners who don't know, preparators are I feel like the backbone to everything, because curators plan exhibitions, you have registration and collection managers that like manage the collection, but preparators and installers are like really the people who carry the artwork, physically carry it in and out of the galleries, hang it, find out ways to innovatively hang it on the artwork. But yeah, unfortunately, it's been dominated by males.
I also think it's like one of the most exciting moments to like problem solve the most like absurd situations.
Absolutely. I've right? seen some crazy stuff. Yeah.
And it's interesting because first, it is a job that as an artist, you know, if you're an artist, you could access this type of jobs. Mm-hmm. And I hear a lot of my, you know, women friends or like queer friends who are artists be like, how do I get a job in the art world? This seems so impossible,
sure,
right?
Sure, yeah.
And of course, that's like, that's systemic. It's not about each one of them, but about creating the opportunities for them to be into that, to enter that world in a way that is supportive. And, you know, with Kat, we always talk about why being a preparer is such it is such a fundamental part of the art world, but it's such a word of mouth profession.
Yeah.
There's not really a manual or a certificate of how to become one.
Yeah.
And what you get paid can change and vary depending on where you're working at or how long you've been there at. So we wanted to, you know, we started doing these mixers. We did one at YBCA. We did another one at Jessica Silverman Gallery. And we kind of just opened it up to people. We're like, you identified as a woman or queer, trans, person of color who is doing work in the arts. Like, let's just meet each other.
Yeah.
And it was, in a way, overwhelming seeing how much interest there was for this type of initiative.
Sure.
And to also see that people were traveling from, you know, from like Fresno or like Santa Rosa.
Really? You were getting people from that far?
Yeah, we were getting people from far away. And, you know, of course, the story was like, oh, I didn't know there were other women preparers, or I'm the only queer person here. Like, I've been working with my boss for a year and they don't call me by name. Or,
yeah, that's,
you know,
crazy.
There's a lot of harassment, you know, all this type of stories that we're not surprised by. So we started doing the Women Art Handlers group in a much more serious way. And then, Kat and I were getting a lot of gigs from different people, and so we started coming up with a spreadsheet and organizing people's information so that we could funnel the opportunities back to other people. And now we're currently doing some workshops at the Art Institute as part of the public education.
At SFAI, you do, yeah. Really?
Yeah, so we're doing workshops this spring. They were filled up and there was a wait list, which is always a good
that's,
sign.
That's great, yeah.
That, you know, that it needs to happen.
What kind of things are you guys teaching?
So we've taught things such as like what's the basics to have in your toolbox, different types of hanging devices for different types of weights, just how to use different tools. We did like a demonstration of the wood shop, so we all got to use a table saw and different like wood shop tools. And in a way it's a matter of like let's do this together, let's like practice together and, you know, take away the sense of competition that there is often in these workplaces. There's a lot of attitude about being like, oh, you don't know how to do it, like, let me do it. Instead of being like, hey, maybe you haven't done this before, this is how, you know, maybe we can do it together this way.
Sure.
So we also want to change the culture of those things, because it tends to be very secretive, it tends to be very show-offy.
Yeah, I have noticed that with some of the preparers. Oh, yeah, for sure. Some of the preparers I've worked with, it's pretty, I do get that vibe.
Yeah, and for us, it's really important to foster a space of collaboration, of working together. Like, there are a lot of moments where you might be doing things that are actually unsafe for you just to, like, you know, prove that they're, that, like, they know what they're doing. And, of course, it's not everybody, but there's a culture there that needs to be changed. And especially in a moment where a lot of institutions are realizing their lack of diversity.
Yeah.
So we also wanted to organize ourselves in terms of labor practices, because even in the Bay Area, there are institutions that are paying $20 an hour. There's other ones that are paying $27. There are other ones that are paying $25.
Yeah.
So there's not really a lot of transparency between institutions. And we want to give these folks like tools so that they can also advocate for themselves and one another.
You know, it's interesting too, because I work as a registrar and I interact with a lot of preparators. And what's crazy is that being in that position, they know a lot about a lot. Like, there's things that I have to ask them, like, what do you think? Because I can't, you will know more than me about this. And just from the experience that they gain. And there's one woman where I work who was a preparator, and she's now recently transitioned to registration. And because she felt, I think, at that point that she's learned everything she could as being a preparator, but she wanted to take what she learned to the next level. And I tell you, like, I talk to her all the time, because there are a lot of things in my job, I have to know about, like, basic things like how to hang works, whether or not a work needs to have a D-ring on it, whether or not how to properly crate something, and what are the different types of crates. Uh-huh. I don't know this, but she does.
Yeah.
And I pick her brain, like, all the time. And I can't tell everyone enough, like, how much that helps me. And in return, like, she has stuff that she asked me about to learn how to be a registrar. And that exchange, I find so much value in that exchange.
Absolutely.
Like, and it's that kind of thing where you're right, the art world can be very competitive, especially working in the museum world, and I don't understand it, because in the end, we all are doing different types of jobs and doing different types of things. Like, we could just be exchanging information instead of having to be competitive with one another about it.
Totally.
Yeah.
And it comes from a same mentality of greediness of, like, if you know what I know, you will take my job
away.
Which is, like, how, you know, the same mentality of xenophobia, which is not actually true, right?
Right, it's not true.
In the same thing with our work environment. Like, if you all have good relationships with one another, you're much more accountable to whatever you're doing than if you're, you know, mandated to do something or forced to do something, right?
Absolutely.
So it's been a really beautiful process. People have opened up. I think Kat and I are incredibly moved by people's honesty and willingness to be a part of it. And we're also trying to find different groups who are doing similar work around the state. So we talked to Level It in Seattle, and we started some conversations about, like, what's working for them, you know, how we could collaborate in the future.
Sure.
So looking at, our field in a much more broader way.
Yeah.
Especially when, you know, I did a lot of unpaid labor in New York when I first started.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how you start getting those jobs, which is weird, because who can afford to be unpaid?
Yeah, isn't that the thing about the art world, right? You have to, like, work for free, like, for a while before you, like, they give you, like, a real job. And it's silly, because
it's so silly.
It really narrows down who are fortunate enough to be able to withstand that long enough to get that job.
Totally.
Yeah.
And even at that point, like, you know, people would treat you almost like I don't know.
No.
Like, you were an actual person.
It's almost like and like an indentured servant sometimes.
Yeah. And you're like, this hierarchy is so arbitrary. Like, I'm actually doing a lot of the work to make your vision materialize in a way.
Right.
So I don't know. It seems so outdated to still have those, like, hierarchies.
Yeah, I agree.
Place, but
so aside from all these things, just to add the cherry on top of all of this, you have now gone into also curating, right?
Yeah.
And recently you just curated a show ever at Southern Exposure. And I think you sit on their curatorial advisory committee?
Curatorial council.
Curatorial council. And is that recent, the thing that you decided to do was to start to also curate shows?
I've actually curated for a while now, but I think, you know, I started mostly in San Francisco when I used to had a gallery in the Mission District with my partner at the time that was called Nuruf Gallery.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, I did a lot of work in alternative art spaces in New York.
Sure.
So when I moved to San Francisco, I was trying to think about ways of getting to know the community. And we started doing site-specific shows in the backyard and the basement, and I was doing my MFA, so it was a way to give you know, my peers also opportunities to show work. And I remember when it started, you know, 50 people came, and at the end of the year, there were like 300 people would like come to the night. So it was a really fun project, and that's how I met a lot of people that I like continue to work with today.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, you can make a wonderful experience out of you know, of being resourceful. So I've curated different things also with Angel Rafael Vasquez. We curated a Control Chef collective. But this, you know, the Curatorial Council of Southern Exposure, it's kind of like a new initiative in which instead of having like a director and a one curator, they're having a council that's formed by like 8 to 10, you know, Korean visual artists who are based in the Bay Area to you know, decentralize a little bit of the curatorial voice of the space.
That's cool.
Yeah, and I like it because I have gotten to know folks deeper in those things.
Yeah.
We definitely had seen each other around before, but now we all sit in a table, share a meal, and talk about ideas and artists that we want to, like, give visibility to.
Right. Yeah, you don't have just one voice dictating what shows can come in and out. You have multiple voices.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And we're aligning on what we think is important and who we think should be shown more.
Do they rotate people on the council?
Yeah, every year more people come in, some people leave. It's a more organic process.
Absolutely,
than that.
Yeah.
And people get nominated to apply. So it, I think it's working towards being a more inclusive process. And so, you know, through doing that, I've been on that for over a year now. The idea for this show came into being, and this show is called The Tallest Part of the Arch. And I was looking at architecture as ways of how we are defined socially. And the cool thing about arches is that the last stone that you place in an arch is the one that makes the whole structure like structurally sound.
Yeah.
And, you know, I take the metaphor of this last stone that's farthest away from the base as those people that are in between spaces, that are diasporic, or that are, you know, gender non-conforming in one way or another. And I wanted to lift up their voices in a way of, you know, I think that marginalized, quote unquote, are always victimized in one way or another, and especially in how they're being depicted in the media. So I wanted to choose different artists that are dealing with immigration and movement and gender expression in a way that has to do with their own representation, right? So you have, I was working with Humanizing Deportation, which I actually got to know through someone who was part of the Women Are Handlers. But she, Aida, was directing these videos where she was recording people who had been deported from the States to share their stories. So you can go and see the stories and, in a way, hear real stories of people who are being deported and see them in their own voice describing who they are and what they've been going through rather than, like, the media talking about it in a way
point.
That's so unpersonalized.
It changes your... It completely can change someone's perspective on something. You're right. It was used to seeing on the news, but when you... It's like raw footage. You're listening to somebody. There's not a famous reporter interviewing them. It's just like, that's it. Like,
yeah, and especially in this moment in time, and also in understanding that our, you know, how we are defining undocumented folks in the States can be criminalized all the time, and hearing them from their own voice is just so different and still heartbreaking in so many ways, and so truthful to their experiences. So that's a little bit of what's in the show. There's also Jamil Helu's Hughes Project, which is incredible.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've recognized a couple of people that are in Band 8. And again, the show, that was really cool. You get to collaborate with them again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's like posing there with different people who come from different places. And there's this idea of hybridity being, experienced in a different way. And I don't ever think that I've seen portraits like that before.
They're great. I mean, I talked to a lot of people about this, about the idea of duality, where I think more and more you know, there isn't just one version of ourselves, right? Like we always have another version, and sometimes we keep it to ourselves, and whether for whatever various reasons. But I thought it was really cool that he did this portrait series where he got people to talk about the other, the part of them that they wouldn't think anybody else would really know about, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, he was able to illustrate it through a photograph, which is really great.
Yeah, it's truly a really wonderful, you know, play with representation and portraiture.
Oh, absolutely.
And then, you know, there's Javier Ocampo, who is an artist who lives in Mexico, who is climbing up all these sculptures in Cuernavaca.
Yeah.
And, like, making out with them. I think he raises a lot of questions regarding eroticizing historical monuments. And in that way, kind of questioning, you know, the way that history is made and shown so fixed in like cement, you know,
that's true.
In order to like prove itself.
Right, like forever, you can't take it down.
Yeah. I find that kind of happening absolutely, you know, it's like playful, it's funny, it makes you question a lot of things, and it also makes you question your understanding to public space. I think there's a lot of different layers of the exhibition. You have Maria Paz ceramics, which tell a lot of different stories, and for the viewers, it tells it in a way where if something relates to you, it's because you know a little bit about it.
Yeah.
But it's not trying to tell you the whole story. It's not trying to for you to understand the 100% of it, but just giving you clues. And then for the person who feels like alluded, you know, the story is more for them. And they probably share something with them.
Yeah.
With the artist to begin with. And the other cool thing that we did, you know, Christina Victor is doing these incredible flags, and Susana Slava also did these frame printed pieces that were really beautiful. And then I commissioned four writers to write on the themes of the show. And it was cool because, you know, I feel like writers always get asked to write about a show. And this was an opportunity to be like, hey, do you want to be involved in this? Maybe you can write about, you know, something that relates to you. So we had Giovanna Venegas, who, like, you know, was born in, like, Tijuana, San Diego border area. Then you have Angel Rafael Vasquez Concepcion, who's, like, Puerto Rican. You have Juliana Delgado Lopera, who's Colombian. And then you have Jackie Valle, who was born in Miami, but her parents were from Cuba. So I think there was a lot of movement in all of the pieces. And there's a printed matter that was designed by a Puerto Rican designer, Juan Carlos Rodriguez.
Yeah, that was cool that you were able to, in some way or some form, exhibit the writings. Right,
yeah.
Like it isn't just something like it's like part of a catalog. They had to buy the catalog to know. No, it's like on display in a pot. You put it's a stack of all these printout papers of all their writings, and you did it in Spanish as well. Which was really cool.
Yeah, it's always fun, you know, to just I'm like yes, of course, it
right.
makes sense. And these are old notes, right?
Right. So
the stack of papers is like Felix Gonzalez Torres
right,
inspired.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Margaret Tedesco used to have a second floor projects in her house.
Yeah.
And she used to always commission a writer. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing that and being like, ah,
yeah.
It's such a simple thing that actually is so meaningful. And so I like, you know, acknowledging where things that I felt moved by are coming from. And then also taking them as opportunities to collaborate with other people. And then there was Purin's work. That was the Google translation machine.
I saw that. That was really cool.
Yeah, and I remember seeing that piece 2 years ago. And you talk to it, and then it translates it to Thai and then back to English. But it talks about the inexactitude of translation and the slippage of language in such a beautiful way, you know. I think, especially when you see it in a machine, that's the process that a bilingual or, you know, person is going through in their brains and seeing it in such a way. It's always fascinating, and it really moves me. And of course, it plays around, and it's funny, and gets people, you know, just, like, excited.
No, that's a very good description of it, like, where that's how, because I speak Spanish, too, and I grew up speaking Spanish first, And then eventually, as I grew older, I was bilingual, and my mother spoke, you know, for the first, I don't know, 6 years of my life, my mother was not a fluent English speaker. It wasn't until I was in high school that she was, but that took a while. So in the meantime, I'm going back and forth. And it's funny because even now, where most people speak to me, and I'm pretty good at English, where you can't really pick it up, but there are times where I'm having a conversation and I'm like stuck on a word.
Yeah.
And whether I'm speaking English or I'm speaking Spanish, and it's because what is happening in my mind is that thing with that Google Translate machine is doing.
Totally.
And I thought that was so cool because I was like, that is what it looks like in my mind. And it's hard to explain it to people who don't know.
And there's such a beauty in it too.
Yeah.
In that, like, I can see another Spanish speaker say something a little funky in English, and I'm like, I know exactly why you say that. I mean, it just sounds much better like that. Don't even change it.
My wife, who's white, she's born American, she's American, and one of the things when I was saying, I was pronouncing salmon, salmon, because I was so grew up with the word of it being salmon, right? And I think people had just let me get away with it, I think, where I just call it salmon. And I think one time when we were dating, she was like, you know, it's salmon, right? I goes, what? It's salmon. You keep saying salmon. Like, you don't even have to pronounce the L. And I was like, but in Spanish, it's salmon. Why would you? It's there. Why would you not pronounce it? And I remember, and I still have moments like that where she told me it's not pronounced, like, it's this way. And I was like, sorry. It's like, that's that translation in my mind. It's
Which is interesting, right? Like,
You
think about Spanish as a language in which you pronounce every single word that you see. I mean, depending on where you're from.
Right?
But English doesn't work that way at all. And it's actually really hard. You know.
Oh, yeah.
I have too many examples. I don't even want to get into them.
Well, and then we recently got married, and we decided for our honeymoon, we went to Barcelona.
Mm-hmm.
And we went there, and we could get around because I could speak Spanish. And even then, like, just to add a whole nother layer, their Spanish is different for what my Spanish was, and even, like, words were pronounced differently than how I was pronouncing them. So then even sometimes there were moments where we're all staring at each other like, what are you saying? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm repeating the word in Spanish. You're like, that's not what we call it here. But it is a beautiful thing because I think the cool part is when moments like that happen, at least internationally or met people who are internationally, it never turns into a moment of like embarrassment or shamefulness. It kind of like connects us a little bit more, I feel
like. Totally.
Right?
And I mean, I wanted to get to a moment where it's more playful and more connection, but
we
all know that there is also this more general view that if you do have an accent, you're going to be treated differently, which does happen.
Right.
So we also have to change our perception of how we are seeing other people who are utilizing language differently, right?
Yeah.
Because even when I came to the States, I remember being like, how do I make my accent better? Seamless, so that when I make a phone call, the person doesn't change their attitude once they hear me, right?
Yeah, and God knows I've witnessed that.
Yeah. I see the beauty of it. We all do. Especially as bilingual speakers. But, like, I think there's a lot of groundwork that needs to be done to acknowledge that we all think and speak very differently, and that doesn't make us less smart or less hireable or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's the big takeaway, I think, when I went to go see your show, that show was this, just the beauty of, like, the diversity of behind the people who make the work, the diversity in the work itself, right? You have ceramic work, you have video work, you have, like, textile work, you even have photography in there, you even have written work. I felt like it was a microcosm of what I think a lot of institutions can be when you what it can look like when you diversify the people that you exhibit.
Absolutely.
Right?
And give the space for people to be who they are too, right? And this was so crazy, but this was one of the smoothest projects I've ever done. And I think it comes from working with people who I had, you know, past relationships with. I've always admired their work. We've seen each other here and there. I mean, some of them I didn't know, but I don't know if it was the themes or the values that we have around the themes. But the exhibition came together so seamlessly, and for me that speaks about, you know, what collaboration can really be, and it doesn't really happen often, right?
Right.
How do we work better together is such a hard question, and when it happens, you know it.
Yeah, you know? It just clicks, right?
It just makes sense. And it was interesting because I remember Valerie Imus from Southern Exposure, the opening night, she was like, okay, so who's coming from the artists? And I was like, well, Javier is in Mexico, Susana is in Colombia, because, you know, humanizing deportation folks aren't here because they were deported. Maria Paz is having some trouble with her visa, so she's not here. Cristina Victor had to move to New York.
That's crazy.
So we had two artists there, and then the writers, some of them were there. And it was a packed opening, which was really wonderful.
Yeah. Which is crazy, right? Just you listing all those things, the issues that they all have of why they couldn't show up, I think really speaks volumes of what's going on today, because where you have this beautiful show and this beautiful artwork and all these, you have a packed house for everyone who wants to see it here in the United States, yet the people who are making it like can't make it for these various reasons, which is silly, right?
Yeah.
It shouldn't be that way.
It shouldn't. And it also speaks about the power of art also in a way, right? Someone might not be able to be there physically, and yet their voice is there, and their, you know, their own artwork is there to represent themselves.
Absolutely.
So I also see a beauty in that.
Yeah, and the success of their work that they're able to illustrate what their voice is without them having to be there to explain it to a crowd.
Exactly.
And with a microphone, and like, oh, here's what my work means. Yeah,
totally.
That's great. I'm happy for you. I'm happy that I love that I'm seeing you curate more. I mean, you're just like a roundhouse of talent. So it's really great, and I'm glad I got to have you back on here. I know the last time we talked, it was like, I think we talked for like an hour, but we could have easily gone for 2 hours, I remember, and I was like, I'll have you back. I have to have you back on.
But, no, thank you so much for inviting me. This is always such a good, you know, opportunity for us to catch up.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And you just work across the street from me. So
I know.
It's Well, quickly, when does the show end over at Southern Exposure?
So the tallest part of the arch closes on March 30th.
Okay.
So go check it out. Take a poster.
And then anything coming up we have anything to look forward to in the next couple months?
I'm working right now towards... I'm making a lot of different types of bodies of work because I hadn't had time to work on my own stuff for a bit. But there's a mural that I've been working with for a middle school, Making Waves Academy. That's actually going up tomorrow morning.
That's great.
So that's going to be up very soon. We made it in collaboration with the students there. And then I'm also doing some pieces for the Precarious Life show at Some Arts. In the summer, it's part of the Queer Arts Festival, and it's going to be created by Rudy Lemke.
Nice.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks again for coming on.
Yeah.
It was good to see you again.
Likewise.
All right, bye.
Thanks for listening, and thanks again to Marcela for coming back on. The tallest part of the arch closes this weekend on Saturday, March 30th, so please be sure to visit the Southern Exposure before it ends. To learn more about Marcela and the work she does, visit the podcast website at artscenepc.com. I'll have up all of the links for her personal website, Women Art Handlers, and Southern Exposure. Please be sure to leave a rating or a comment on Apple Podcasts. It would be much appreciated. And finally, please be sure to follow the podcast on Instagram at artscenepc. Till next time.